Hey, this is Byron Builds, and you're listening to the Builders Sessions.
Welcome to the Builders Sessions, a podcast where we chat with your favorite builders.
We get to know them, their stories, and hopefully inspire you to get off the couch and build something cool. I'm Hoff.
And I'm Rosie.
And on this episode, we chat with Byron Schmidt of Byron Builds. We talk about the commercial side of carpentry and framing, the importance of having a drive when learning, and how investing in yourself is crucial to your development and success as a skilled tradesperson.
All this and more on this episode of the Builders Sessions. Byron, welcome to the Builder Sessions.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
We're excited. For our listeners who aren't aware of who you are, what you do, or aren't part of the 92,000 strong followers you have on Instagram, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a family guy mostly. That's what keeps me going. I am a forming and framing carpenter out of Chilliwack, British Columbia. We're doing mostly the residential side of commercial construction. So mid-rise multifamily construction. And then along with that comes a little bit of like the commercial mixed use buildings and parkades and that type of thing. So I'm actually working on one of our biggest projects right now, which includes a grocery store, a potential hotel, and 700 housing units. So that's me, just a carpenter that builds big things.
I don't know where to start. Lots of concrete work if you're doing parkades, hotels. Is that the majority of the type of work?
So when I started being a full-time carpenter, it was mostly wood frame construction we were doing. And in the last probably three or four years, kind of when COVID hit and world got weird, it switched a little bit to doing a lot of concrete. And we basically got two crews on the company that I'm with. And I've been generally on the concrete side most recently, but yeah, wood frame, concrete, all that kind of stuff.
So, okay. So the title you said was framing carpenter.
Yes.
Okay. So for people like me who have no clue about woodworking, I'm trying. what exactly is that?
So it's a carpenter's role. Well, the way that I like to say it, if it's not plumbing, HVAC, or electrical, it's carpentry.
Yeah.
Right. So for a framing carpenter, you're looking at like obviously framing walls, framing floors, framing roofs.
Oh, okay.
But then that also includes things like false work for concrete placement, footings, foundations, walls, suspended slab work. We're going from groundwork to basically lock up. Doors and windows go in and we leave.
Wow. So Hoff's over here like, oh, that's the dumbest question you could ask.
No. There's no stupid questions on no, the
I
show No,
I love it. So how'd you get into it? What was your start? Like, how did you, because there's like so many ways that over the guests that we've had, some people were inspired by a shop teacher they had, some people just kind of stumbled onto it and stuck with it. Like what was your background in it, or how did you get involved in it in the first place?
So we'll go in the Wayback Machine for this one, 'cause it's a long story.
Cool. Love it.
So if I was like 15, 16 years old right now, I'd probably be sitting in one of your classrooms, and that would be where the majority of my day would be. When I was in high school, I spent all of my time in the shop class. If I wasn't there, I was in the music room playing guitar.
Oh, cool.
So I loved working with my hands as a kid and a teenager. But the the public school system really let me down in not showing me that I could make money with those skills.
Right.
It was go to university. And I didn't want to go to university, so I didn't take my sciences. I didn't take any classes to go to post-secondary education. And I was heavily involved with our church at the time. And I liked spending time with the youth. I was present in the youth programs there. So I was going to do the youth pastor role. And so I went to Bible school for 4 years. Started an internship and realized very quickly that sitting behind a desk and doing the politics of people was not fulfilling for me. Still believing the lie that a desk job was the way to fulfillment, I went into sales, and I sold hardwood flooring for a little while with a local manufacturer, and then that didn't work out. So I tried selling and designing kitchen cabinets for a franchise ring. That didn't work out. And I just came to a crossroad. We had just had our first kid. And I was like, I need to make some money to pay for our kid and our house, because we had just bought a house. And my wife, for years before that already, had said, just go frame, go work in the trades, go do something. And I was like, I don't want to be outside, all that kind of stuff. And the weather sucks, and it's the Fraser Valley, so it's always raining, you know. And so I just put on my work boots. Actually, I made a phone call first, but I asked my current boss, and I was like, hey, can I start? He's like, yeah, when do you want to? And
oh, cool.
I just jumped in both feet because I needed a job. And it was just supposed to be temporary. And that's coming up on 12 years ago.
Sweet.
Wow. So you've done a little bit of everything then, from selling like hardwood. You just mentioned cabinet design. So you've got a kind of a pretty broad knowledge of everything encompassing like carpentry, woodworking, kind of a nice skill set to have.
Yeah. So a few of the parts of the journey that I left out there is I worked in the hardwood flooring factory as well before selling there. So I manufactured hardwood flooring.
Oh, that's cool.
And before I was ever selling cabinets to pay for college, I manufactured and installed cabinets at a small shop in Saskatoon where I grew up.
Oh, cool.
So wow. I've done the cabinetry, I've done the flooring, I've done framing, I've done forming. And then I'm sitting in my backyard wood shop where I do more finish work just for fun.
No need to brag, Byron.
this is a long time coming. We were in a townhouse for many years, and I had a garage with a corner that was about 7.5 feet by 8 feet with my table saw in the middle of it. And it's nice to have a bigger space, but I should have built it bigger.
That's what they all say.
So after going from carpentry, like rough carpentry, formwork, concrete, do you find it relieving? I'm asking this question because I'm a cabinet maker myself and I enjoy the finishing side. Do you find the stuff you do after hours or on the weekends, like the fine woodworking stuff you mentioned, do you find that relieving and kind of something that kind of centers you and brings you down from maybe a hectic or stressful day?
Oh yeah, I'd way rather be in here than out in the field. But that's also because it's working on things that I want to be working on. Mm-hmm. Rather than things I need to be working on.
Right.
So
more of a want than a need.
Yeah. Yeah. The hours can fly by very quickly in here. But it's also very fulfilling. I did originally want to get back into cabinetry before heading into the framing, but I just didn't have any connections here with that industry. And I had an in, or at least someone I knew who was framing and needed help. So
now, did you do your apprenticeship? Do you have your ticket in carpentry? Or are you?
Yeah. I completed my red seal in a record of 2 years and 4 months.
Oh wow!
So I took the fast track.
So did you go to BCIT now that you're in the? I'm not really familiar with, I guess, mainland BC, but I went to BCIT for cabinet making. Is that where you went to school, or is there other options around where you are?
No, there's one right in Chilliwack here. It's UFV. University of the Fraser Valley.
Okay. Yeah.
So they've got a trades campus here, and the carpentry program is based out of that. So
okay. Nice. Yeah. So nice local. You don't have to travel anywhere for schooling, which is always a bonus,
yeah,
right?
Seriously.
I didn't get that sweet, sweet travel allowance though. So
neither did I. And I had to travel about 14 hours from my hometown. So sometimes that's lies. The travel allowance is the EI that you're on while you're at school, which isn't much to cover food and all that stuff. So did you take, you mentioned being in shop class in high school. Was that just like the woodworking, carpentry? Was there metal? Did you dabble in automotive or anything? Or was it mostly just wood shop?
So in Saskatoon at the time, that's where I grew up, each of the high schools basically had their own shop focus. And my grandpa was a hobbyist woodworker. So I think that's what bent me toward the woodworking. I was interested in taking automotive as well, but I would have had to go to a different campus and I didn't want to go to that school. And the shop was... or the wood shop was more important. So that's where I got stuck. Unfortunately, multiple trades weren't an option to take.
That's interesting.
Wow. Yeah, because nowadays, typically, the schools kind of provide all of those options. But to have, I guess that's a good way to utilize your resources and just focus on one stream, I guess, or one trade. And then that way you don't have to worry about trying to stretch, you know, six programs, maybe a bit thinner. But maybe a little bit trickier for students because now you've got to decide which school. Like, could you go to another school and take, say, automotive and then come back to the one you're at? Or do you have to fully enroll in that school at the time?
I'm pretty sure it was a full enrollment in the school to have access to those programs.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because it would have been nice to at least do kind of a semester of each.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, get your toes wet and see what you actually like. Because before I went, you know, head first into the carpentry as a career, I did consider doing the automotive as a career because I was working on a project car at the time. And I did enjoy that, but it was like, okay, where's the line between, I want to keep this as a hobby and a passion, or do I want to do this as a career? And I thought I would keep up on doing the automotive stuff, but with four kids and a woodworking hobby already, I don't have the time for a car.
Yeah, finding that out.
The minivan's not too modifiable, so.
Hey, minivan, that's where it's at, man, I'm telling you. What kind of minivan do you have?
It's a 2016 Dodge Grand Caravan.
Nice.
Yeah. It fits a sheet of plywood in the back, so that's nice.
That's, hey.
Or the only good use for a minivan.
Hey,
in my books.
You've got your tongue. We got a Sienna, and you can. There's some aftermarket. There, you can. I don't know why. Probably for people like me, but you can buy a TRD supercharger for the Sienna. You know. Well, hey. Side note. I don't know why I feel like I need to defend what I'm saying right now. Insecure.
Because I'm here. You know how I feel about minivans.
I know, and it's awesome. You know the guy from Fast and Furious? His character is Han. The guy who got hit, you know, in Tokyo, and then he came back. He has a Toyota Sienna, and he's like, this is my favorite car that I own. But my favorite car on the planet.
Really?
Yeah, and he's like lowered it a little bit. I'm just sitting here trying to justify minivan ownership. It's okay. I'll be over here now.
Pretty nice body kits for that one, too.
Hey, it's not bad. I don't know. They look kind of neat. But we bought it during COVID because our Honda Odyssey blew up. And there was two Honda brand new Honda Odysseys and the Sienna in all of our town here, well, where we're at. And we had to get the Sienna. But we also paid probably double the price that it was actually worth because COVID. Yeah. Anyways, so... With your, I could kind of see, okay, so tell me if I'm wrong here, because I kind of have a similar background in like the youth pastor kind of, I did some work with like in kind of like a youth ministry role for a couple of years, and then I got my ed degree. But in your, is there like a parallel or some sort of connection between with that? You kind of have to have a love of teaching, I guess, a little bit. Is there a connection between that and, let's say, the videos that you do, because you know, your carpentry technique videos that you do? Is there still like, does that kind of scratch the teaching itch for you, even though that you kind of not officially like a pastor or a teacher or any sort of guide that way?
Yeah, the teaching videos, they're kind of my bread and butter. It's what really launched this whole journey. I never intended to be, you know, quote unquote famous on the internet. But the teaching for me really is there to keep my own skills sharp.
Oh, interesting.
Because if I can't break it down simple enough to teach it to someone else, I probably don't know it well enough myself. So a lot of the like stair math and rafter videos that I've done came out of sitting with guys in carpentry school who were having trouble understanding it. So I would have to find different ways to explain it. And it really solidified how the theoretical part of it worked. And so in order to keep, because I'm doing a lot of commercial and apartment stuff, there's not a huge opportunity to use the details of that, because it's a lot of repetitive stuff, but it's not something I want to, you know, I learned it. I don't want to not use it and then forget it. So the teaching of it and then teaching it in different methods, it just keeps it fresh in my brain, and then allows, like, all that stuff is, it's not just a single use item. Because if you understand it, you can extrapolate it to different scenarios. Mm-hmm. So if I can keep it sharp for myself, that means I can better teach the guys that I'm working beside if they're not understanding, or I can extrapolate that information into a different sector where it still applies. Like, I would have never thought going into carpentry school that trigonometry would be the thing that I use the most. And trigonometry was something that I just never paid attention to in school. So I was like 27 years old, sitting at my kitchen table, teaching myself math. And then it finally clicked when I applied it to something. Mm-hmm. So it's wanting to keep my own skills sharp, so that I can do better at everything, kind of thing.
That's so intelligent, you know, to be able to, because like you said, you know, there's so many sectors of every trade, you know, mostly I was involved with residential and, you know, electricians and plumbers, there's lots of residential, and then there's commercial. Commercial seems like, mm-hmm, it's a whole new beast, compared to residential, right? Different codes and different materials and mediums you're using. So to do that, I mean, it's so easy to go through school and pick up this stuff. And you had mentioned too, when you were in school, that you weren't able to, or you were able to apply it and then the light went off. And we deal with students all the time. I was one of those students who didn't excel in math. I did okay, but there was no really way to apply it. Then you get into the trades and, you know, tape measure reading, you know, dealing with fractions, all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, when you're actually having to apply that into something you enjoy, I feel like it just starts to come a bit, obviously there's work in it, but you have to, you know, it comes natural and you kind of get excited to use this new skill set that you have. Yet when we're dealing with high school kids and even lots of adults who don't have that outlet to be able to apply themselves into something, you know, if you're at a desk, it'd be hard to maybe pick up math and numbers depending on what you're doing. But to be able to have that hands-on, you know, measuring studs or, you know, cutting formwork, rafters, whatever, there's a lot of math that you need to be on the ball with, or stuff can go sideways.
or it'll just be way over your head. There's one of the guys that I worked with for a couple of years when I was still learning myself and hadn't even explored school as an option yet. He was doing a valley set on the front of a house. It was one of the few single family homes that I've actually worked on. He was doing a valley set on the front of the house, and there was a unequal pitch hip roof covering a patio that tied into the main house at the back, and there needed to be some hand-cut rafters that tied them together. And being unequaled pitch, it's not just, you know, trace the truss and put something in, right? And so went over to the front of the house. He's like, "Hey, how do I do this?" He's like, "Just plane it out." I was like, "What? How do I just plane it out? Like, there's got to be, I don't know where the top of this is supposed to go, and the bottom is supposed to meet with this, but these angles are completely different. And I, which area do I plane it out? Like, I can make multiple planes on this because there's so much unknown between." And so I just said, I did plane it out because that's the only advice I was given. So going to school and then learning like how the geometries come together and, you know, where your benchmarks are going to be for measuring off of and what math needs to go on. And, you know, the difference between a theoretical line and a line that has material thickness and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot that goes into the understanding. And so, yeah, if you lose the edge on that information, you're going to struggle.
Mm-hmm. And with stairs, I remember we did, I think stairs was third year. So joinery is the technical term for, mm-hmm. I don't know why they don't call it cabinetting, but I was in the joinery program.
It's all joiners are carpenters, but not all carpenters are joiners.
Yeah. So we had this stair unit. And third year, I'm a cabinet maker, full blown, you know, I've never dealt with stairs, stringer layouts, that stuff. And we had a project to do that we had to lay it out on to scale on big graph paper or whatever, like, I don't know, an 8-foot roll. And I found it so hard because I wasn't able to apply my skill sets. This was me learning something new and all the math. We also had to do windows and sills and all that stuff. But watching your videos on Instagram, I watched quite a few of them. And the stair ones, when you just sit back and listen, I feel like you break it down, like you said, to very simple steps. And I look at that and I'm like, if I had something like that or a resource like that in school, I feel like I would be able to pick that information up easier and probably retain it more. You know, sometimes they go through all the, you know, A, B, C, D to find this number. And I was so confused, and maybe I wasn't able to apply myself and I wasn't into it because I've never built a stair stringer or calculated, you know, what would it be, risers and all that rise and run stuff that you do in your videos. Yep. I'm just like, oh, light is on. I want more of this because I feel like, you know, you can just, I want to save this video. And then if I ever need to calculate that, whether it's for a deck or something, you know, it's right there because you've got it broken down into very simple steps and understandable.
It's interesting though. There's always the, I don't know if it's the haters or the keeners or a combination of both, but there's always the group of people that come out with the stair videos. Cause I do try to keep it simple as like, this is the entry level of getting into stairs. And then they're like, oh, you didn't account for material thickness on the landing or on the floor that you're coming off of. And what if they differ? And it's okay. This is simple tip Sunday, not confuse you Tuesday. Right.
So yeah.
Let's grasp this.
Calm
first.
Down.
Let's imagine all of our material thicknesses, all our finishes are the same, and we can get through the basics, and then you'll come to something and they'll have, you know, lino on the top floor and 3/4-inch hardwood on the bottom floor. And then we need to do some shortenings and adjustments and, you know, figure that out. But yeah, if you get the basics first, then we can start talking about the more complex things. And quite often I'll have people DM me after videos like that and ask those specific questions. And then, I'll hand them the information or walk them through what their scenario is, because it is that learning, like, let's grow together. Let's not, you know, gatekeep this stuff, because we need houses, right? We're behind on housing. So let's work together and build this country, right? So
exactly.
And not everybody has access to this information. You know, there could be an apprentice or a company doing something who, even simple tricks of you're using a speed square
that
with
was
a plumb bob to find level.
Awesome.
Right? Just little things. I'm like, holy frick. Like this is, I don't know. Just out. I feel like there's a lot of people that retain or keep their information, keep their secrets, their tips. And you know what? That's totally fine. If you've, you know, put a lifetime of work into something, you don't want to give yourself stuff away. But these tips and tricks and just, I don't know. I feel it's so valuable, especially with everybody being, you know, this generation coming up who are always on their phones and, you know, to find information readily and fast. Well, now you've got stuff, you know, you could be on site, you know, a young apprentice, their journeyman leaves them to go do some stuff and they don't remember what they were told. I mean, they could find some of this stuff and, you know, and you're accessible, right? Like you're saying, people can message you and like that. I think that's a really cool thing. Social media has gone, there's obviously pros and cons, but one pro is that people can share information, can talk to you over, you know, messages, texts, whatever, and figure out solutions to problems that they might not otherwise be able to do that.
Yeah. It's interesting. You get these people who reach out for help and they're grateful. And then you get some other people, they'll reach out with a question or, you know, it's something even simple, just a thank you or whatever. And I try to respond to every message I get. I don't know how long that's going to last for, but then, you know, I'll answer the question. They'll be like, oh, thanks. I never thought you'd reply. Well, that's kind of why I'm on social media. Like it's social media. Like,
Yeah.
I'm going to pretend we're friends, even if we don't know each other. Yeah. Unless you do something that's, you know, not cool.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. What was the first video? Like, what was the first one? And did the first one hit? And then when it did, or like, what made you think, oh, I kind of got something here. Or did you come into it just being like, I'm going to make videos until I start building this thing? Was it intentional?
So the original intention on Instagram was to hit 1,000 followers. Cause I had, you know, the personal account with, you know, the 200 followers with, you know, half of those being friends and family and half of them being randoms. And then, I stumbled on the community of carpenters and trades. And I was just like, hey, these guys are got some big accounts. Maybe I can get to 1,000. And I just started putting content out. And then, one video hit and I'm trying to remember. Oh, it was a speed square video with this one right here. And I was just showing how to do different, like how to find a pitch and then how to find the plumb cut and level cut in different ways. Cause there's like, you can use the pivot to turn out and then you've got your plumb cut and then if you flip the square over on that line, the heel becomes your level cut. But then you can use the pivot again and mark the inside of the square on your pitch and that becomes your level cut. So there's just like multiple ways to use it. And I just showed like, I think reels were, or Instagram videos, reels wasn't a thing yet. Instagram videos were limited to 15 or 30 seconds or something. So I had three or four methods, just bang, 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 showing these things. And then I ended with, and there's your bird's mouth. And posted it. And yeah, that one blew up. And then I just was like, oh, tips are good. So I kept posting tips and then it became a weekly thing. I think I had just over a year solid. I had a Sunday, Simple Tip Sunday video every Sunday, brand new content. And then, yeah, they were all a minute or less, just, you know, doing stair math or rafter math or, you know, tool tips or, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then we packed up our house and moved and I kind of fell off the Simple Tip Sunday wagon, but They still pop up and I'm still making new ones occasionally, just not as consistently as I was. So
you gotta, number one, family's number one, man.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, that educational side, I think, of, you know, the shorter form, you talk about short form, long form. I myself am tied to the shorter form because it's, you know, to watch a, say, a 20-minute video of stair math, or Aftermath, which I don't know nothing about. It's probably going to go right over my head and I'm going to get lost and maybe bored. But that
I've got some good videos on that if you want to simplify it.
Do you?
Yeah. They're Aftermath.
Long form or short form?
No, they're all under a minute.
Yeah, and see, that's my jam.
Toledo.
Like I've made, there's we'll some link videos.
To those. We'll link to those.
Where I save them for even school. You know, I see something or a layout that, you know, some Finnish woodworkers doing, or even carpentry if we do some of that at the shop at the school. And I save some of those videos, or if kids have questions, I'll bring up Instagram and show some save stuff. And it's just, I don't know, something about that short form. And not everybody's like that, but I feel like you can be concise. If you can explain something in a minute and less, clear and concise, I feel like it's just, you remember it better. And yeah, I think the educational side of social media is really cool to see and how it's evolving. That we've had a bunch of guests. Who's the John Hilgenberg, JCH Cabinets. Yeah. We had him Cabinets. On, you know, just explaining how to scribe stuff and, you know, with the tools and processes and theoretical, if you can tie all that together, I could just chat and I could even just listen for days on that stuff. You know, going back into the trades, going back in time, if I had access to that, how much smoother some of those installs and jobs and tasks would have been, you know, cause you're working under somebody who has their skill sets and that's kind of how you're taught, or, you know, when you're going through your apprenticeship or you're working with the company. So sometimes you miss some of that stuff cause your journeyman or your boss, the owner, doesn't have those skill sets to be able to build that up. I think just makes you more well-rounded, and pays off in the long run. So.
Yeah. It's also one of those things where, like, in my line of work, it's production focused, right? We're doing apartments. So it's not, you know, we're not working for one client doing a custom home that they're going to live in forever, right? This is, it doesn't mean it's sloppy. It's just working to a different tolerance, right? Mm-hmm. So we're trying to be as fast as possible. And we have a process which makes us one of the fastest framers in town here. But that doesn't leave a lot of room for teaching like the specific, like, okay, this is how we do this. This is why we do this. And now I'm going to put it in your hands and let you do it. It's more do it this way so we can get it done.
Right.
So I think that was one of the important reasons for myself to go to school, was to give the space to just learn it. And then the job site gives me the opportunity to digest it and hone it and that type of thing. So
do you find that frustrating in that type of work where you don't have time, whether it's for yourself or for, say, an apprentice or, you know, a laborer or somebody that you're working with, to be able to take some time? Like, I know every trade's different and it's probably really hard to carve out a lot of time to be able to fully explain something. But in the commercial side, it sounds like you're just fast paced. You mentioned talking about how trying to get everything built as fast and as quickly as possible. Do you find that frustrating in a sense where you can't break down some of that theoretical knowledge and actually do the teaching to apprentices or, you know, younger generations that you're working with?
There are times when it's a hindrance, but it's usually coworker dependent, right? So there's guys who will come in and they want to be there and they want to learn and they know how to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side of that spectrum, you have guys who are there just to collect a paycheck and they're just a set of hands, right? Mm-hmm. So to teach those guys, it's a waste of time. And then I guess below them is summer help, which it's hard to teach the summer help knowing that they're leaving in, you know, 4 weeks, 8 weeks or whatever. But yeah, there's definitely, I know for myself, I will slow down and teach the guys who are there and want to learn because this is the career path they've chosen. But for guys who are there to collect a paycheck or guys who are less passionate about it, it's like, okay, I'll teach you the role that I need you to do. Mm-hmm. And then that's what they can do. Right. So that's another difference between like a custom home builder and production framing is in the production side of things, there's always jobs that we just need hands to do. And you don't need to be like a high-end skilled carpenter to put in the 700 anchor bolts on the first floor, right? You just need to know how to drill a hole that's 4 inches deep and then smack a quick bolt into it, right? So
do you find a decline in, let's say, your summer help, probably a lot of students? As we get older, and so as we, let's say the, you know, 17-year-old kid, as we get older and then that kid stays 17, is there, have you seen a difference in work ethic and in willingness to learn from that 17-year-old kid over the years?
The biggest change I've seen is the lack of understanding in my cult reference jokes. They don't get them anymore.
You've never seen Dumb and Dumber? I tried quoting that today. I was like, what's the matter? Because this one kid in my class, he looked kind of down. And I was like, what's the matter, Lloyd? Little Philly, break your heart? And I was waiting for him to go, no, it was a girl. And then he's like, what? I was like, have you ever seen Dumb and Dumber? He's like, no, I've actually never seen Dumb. And I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. No, I'll send the kids home with homework for that stuff. It's like, oh, you don't get that one? Go watch this movie, right?
Yeah.
That's your homework for tonight. Come back, we'll discuss in the morning. No, the work ethic thing, it's hit and miss with personalities, really. Like, we've got some young guys on the crew that they work harder than the generation before them, right? So it's, I don't think there's a miss in generational thing. It's a mindset thing, because you can have the lazy employee at any age, it just comes down to mindset and drive of the individual.
I like that answer, because it's very easy to just crap on the new generation, you know? Oh, these young kids, whatever. And I mean, it's true. Like, I've seen it a lot. You see it in teaching every year. There's like, I don't want to be like kids these days, but there's like, kids are great, don't get me wrong, but there is more of an air of entitlement a little bit. And you just have to teach them differently. But at the same time, like you said, I can relate to that as well. Like, there are kids in my classes that work hard. And they're passionate, and they're self-starters, and they're, hey,
the drive.
I'm done this. What else can I do? Can I go do this? Or, hey, I saw this. This could kind of use some improvement. Could I do that? You know, that kind of thing. Do you see that too? Like, as far as kids coming in?
Self-starters?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely a range of personality types out there. And if you're going to walk onto a job site and not have any type of drive, you're not going to survive.
Yeah.
Or if you walk onto a job site without any type of, like, what's the word I'm looking for here? Without any self-motivation, if you walk onto a job site without self-motivation to do something, no one's going to hand that to you, and you're not going to end up where you think you should be. Right. So if you want to be a carpenter or a welder or, you know, anything where you're working on a project, if you don't, even if you know nothing, if you don't get there and then have a drive to do something, you're not going to end up being a lead carpenter or the head welder or, you know, working on the high end stuff or the difficult things or solving problems, because you need to take control of what you're doing and then be able to learn both from the mistakes and from the people around you. But if you just expect to float into a career, it's not going to happen.
No one's going to hand it to you.
Well, and it just doesn't work that way either. Like, here's a piece of advice. Never lie on a resume or an interview for trades work. Because you will be found out the moment you touch the tools, right? Like you can say, oh, I've built this and I've built that and I've built this. Okay.
Do
this simple task.
Prove
if it
it
takes
yeah.
you too long, or it takes you, you know, you can't figure it out, or you're asking for help. After listing all of your accomplishments, it's don't lie on a resume going into the trades. If you don't know, say you don't know.
Have you seen a lot of that?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Yeah. There's lots of guys who, I worked on this and I worked on this. And I've also learned to see that as a red flag. If you've got a laundry list of all the companies you've worked for, it's probably not a good sign.
It's not an indicator of your social life. Let's put it that way.
It's not an indicator of your skill set necessarily either.
Exactly. Oh, that's so funny. Just a laundry list, Dave. Of like, oh yeah, I work for these guys and these guys and these guys and these guys. It's just like page. It's like, oh.
Yeah. And then there's always an excuse. Yeah, I don't work for these guys anymore because, and these guys treated me this way and I don't do it.
And they didn't want to pay me and I'm worth more than that. It's like, oh, are you? That's funny.
Okay. Do you find any of them that are overconfident too? I feel like there's some that, you know, I don't know. I think a lot of this is taught how you were raised, you know, some of the self starting, you know, drive to work, whether you're confident in your, like, you know, you can be confident in your skill sets, but not cocky about them. You know, do you find there's a line between people who are overconfident and talk a big game on these are all the things I can do versus some that are really good, but they kind of stay a bit quiet and just do the work? Do you find there's a fine line between that, or?
Yeah, there's some of that. I don't think it's as prevalent as the talking yourself up as a interview question, right? Because the job site is a pretty humbling spot. If you don't have the skills, they're going to show.
Have you ever seen someone get hired just to kind of you have them do what they said that they're going to do? Like, is that the most awkward thing ever? Like, you've worked on this? Here's the same thing. Go ahead.
I've seen that, not like as a specific social experiment, say, on the job, but it's definitely been like, oh, you've said you've done this before. Why are you asking so many questions?
Oh, yeah. Why are you wasting, especially with the production work, right? Like you said, it's probably really tough to have to. You're asking me this again? Like, we got to get this done. Like, people want to move into these houses or these apartments.
I might be, you know, one of the leads on the crew, but I don't have time to hold your hand on how to, I've got my own things to do to make sure that you have another job later on. Right.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And that's the production side, right? Like, probably a lot of repeatability and, I guess that's in its own mindset and its own too, like you said, right? Like, I mean, obviously you've got your task list for the, whether it's the day, the week, the month. But I feel with that commercial, and I feel about that with a lot of the trades, you know, plumbing, electrical, all that commercial side, is it very like time lucrative? Like, everything's down to, obviously we need to do it well, but it seems like there's a lot more emphasis on completing it in this time. Versus maybe say a custom home or a residential side where there might be a little bit more, and it's not time to slack or anything, but it just seems that production, it's very high paced. And do people get kind of swallowed up in that they can't keep up to that high paced if they're coming in from, I guess what I'm asking is, have you had people from residential come into commercial and get kind of swallowed up just due to the time constraints and that, you know,
That's a good question.
Yeah, there's definitely a learning curve coming into, especially like our wood frame side of stuff, with how quickly and the methodology in which things happen. So we do some of our own in-house wall building as well. So we've got framing tables set up.
Would those be on site framing tables? What's that? Would those framing tables be on site, or would they be in the shop?
We've usually got them either. We did have a shop, and then we've had them out in the like a boneyard off in the distance of of a site, because walls for a 6-story apartment take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
So, I'll not recently, but on the last few projects that I did this on, I was doing the layout for the building. So I've got the plans in front of me, beam saw to cut all the plates. You know, everything's gang cut, everything's gang marked. And then once the layout is done, it's done in such a way that everyone on the production line of the framing tables knows which marks they're looking at. So there's, you know, obviously stud layout, but then cripple lengths are written down, beam lengths are written down, beam types are written down, sheathing stops and starts for overlaps of continuous walls and into wall pockets and all that kind of stuff. It's all noted on the plates so that the guys handling the material know what information they're looking at and what it means for their station. Mm-hmm. And so like it's assembly line of wall building, right? And then we have the same thing when our walls get to site. We've got the crane operator set up with two guys, and they're standing all the sheeted walls. And then once those are up, they land the interior bundle in there and walk away. And two more guys, or even sometimes just a single guy if the units are small, come by, stand all the interior walls and level everything. And then our joister is right behind them, right? So I actually, if you scroll back probably to 2020? I have a picture. It's a panoramic picture cut into panels so you can swipe through it. And it's standing walls on one side, sheathing in the middle, or layout in the middle, and then standing lower walls on the other side. So it's this terraced building of like every step in the process happening at the same time. And it's so the calendar time constraint isn't an issue for us, but the guy chasing you, right? There's always someone coming behind you that's ready to do some work.
And are those guys coming behind you, are they working for the same company usually, or is it another contracted company, or
like it's usually us chasing ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. Because like once I'm done doing layout, I don't want to change tasks and do something else. I want to be up on the next floor starting layout for the next, right?
Yeah.
So it's you're chasing yourself until you get to the roof, and then something changes, and then come back down the building with all your deficiencies and back framing, and then pack up and go to the next one.
Jeez.
Do you find the construct, or the, I guess the framing side, is it, I guess you can talk from commercial, but I notice here in Lethbridge, some companies, and maybe it's the project, some of them are condos or multifamily homes. They're doing they bring in the pre-built walls. Is that becoming more popular? Is that just more efficiency, or what would be the advantages of doing your own pre-built walls versus building them on each floor?
It's definitely an efficiency thing. So for an average unit around here, we're usually standing 5 units a day. So we did a 6-story, and granted this was like the third building on site, and it was kind of a cookie cutter building. Mm-hmm. But we put that building up from concrete slab to ready for trusses, 6 stories in 3.5 weeks.
Wow. Is that something new that's happening?
That's just doing 8-hour days. Like we're not working overtime. We're not working weekends. That's
seriously, eh? Not even, because a lot of those companies, a lot of like even construction or even like stepping back to like the earth moving stuff, when they're prepping the lots and stuff, like as long as there's daylight in the summertime, they're working. So you're just doing regular 8-hour days and you're still being that efficient. That's crazy.
We're just bankers' hours.
That's awesome.
And it's probably more efficient to build the walls on, like, I'm assuming the tables you're building on are probably all level, you know, not twisted up. So you're probably, your room for, or your potential for error is reduced because you've got a nice level flat surface where all your pre-building can happen.
You're also working at a gentleman's height. You're not bent over.
Oh,
right? Mm-hmm. So everything is at standing level. And then all the material is brought to you. So on the one side of the table will be all the bulk studs, and that's, you know, you have your single studs, and then you've got your doubles and your cripples and your double cripples and your three packs and your four packs and all those. We got a guy just nailing those together in the background and refilling the bulk supply. And then on the other side of the table, you've got, you know, your top plates and all your header material, and all that's pre-cut by someone else and nailed together. So the two guys that are assembling walls are just grabbing pieces, nailing them together, slide it down on rollers so it's not even difficult, and then the guy's sheathing it, square it, sheet it, pick it up with a gantry crane and put it on the pile. So the efficiency of motion is where you're saving everything, because if you were to do the same thing, build the same walls on the deck, you'd have, you know, your corridor littered with all kinds of material, whether it's all loose studs or whatever. You'd have bunks and bunks and bunks of material up there, and you'd be walking back and forth and carrying everything and bending over. And so it's just the efficiency of motion. That's where all your time saving is with the panelized walls.
And on the comfort too, right? You're not bent over on your knees or, you know, bending over to try and nail a bunch of plates on. It's everything's comfort level.
Yep.
How much of your, give me a percentage, like how much of your week, let's say, is spent you talking to your colleagues about how to find more efficient ways to do things?
It really just comes out of like where the pain points are, right? So if all of a sudden we're seeing, you know, there's always a slowdown here, or, you know, this guy's taking more steps than he should, we'll find a different method. And that's one thing I really appreciate about my employer too, is he's open to try things. Whereas, you know, we'll call them old timers in the industry, they get stuck in a rut of, no, this is how we do it. Right.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
And it's not like we're already, in the time that I've been framing, which isn't long compared to other guys, we're using new materials and different processes for things, just because code has changed and like step code's now coming in. So we're going to have to rethink some of our processes on that as well. But if we're allowed to try new things and see if they work or don't, then you're already a step ahead, right?
What's step code?
Step code is building envelope efficiency, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So it's a blower door test.
Gotcha.
I don't know if you guys are doing it in Alberta. You're not as green as we are here in BC. Hey,
what are you trying to say?
We're still rolling. We're still rolling the coal
here.
We're
still rolling coal, huh? Oh, yeah.
And I'm jealous.
Well, when you were mentioning all that terminology of cripple studs and all that stuff, it got me to, I saw one of your videos, must have been a couple weeks ago, where you went over, I think you had a story or something about, you're asking about, if you don't know what this stuff is, and you had a book open, that Carpentry by Fred Voigt. I just ordered one for the school, because I don't do a lot of framing and carpentry stuff, but I would like to. So I skimmed through it. I think it came a couple days ago. I skimmed through it and it's wonderful. So I'm excited to dive into that. And again, just a simple little educational video, you know, hey, if you're need some help or a resource to be able to guide some of your challenges, or if you're learning a trade, excellent resource. So thanks for sharing that, because that's stuff I get excited about sometimes too. You know, all these people are spitting, you know, jack stud and all this stuff. And when I start, the limited carpentry or framing that I do, I don't know what the stuff's called. I'm cutting it, right? But to have the terminology, like you said, and be able to have that baseline knowledge so that you can kind of move from there, especially in the teaching standpoint. I don't want to be, you know, telling the students, oh, go cut the stud thingy that goes in between the header and the top plate, you know, like, hey.
Were you at my class today?
Yeah. Huh? You got to be careful with that, though, because those terms are all, like, localized for the most part. So
are they?
That post did really well because it started fights in the comments about what things are actually called, right?
Oh, so, that's awesome.
Like, here we generally call a beam that would go above a window or door a header.
Yeah.
Which is incorrect. If it's load bearing, it would be called a lintel.
A lintel, yeah.
So the header would just be the horizontal member that's at the top, and the lintel would be the weight bearing member that spans across.
See, I knew that.
Did you?
So, like, and then jack studs here would be, you know, anything that's short and unsupporting, whereas in other areas, I don't know in Canada, but I know in the States, jack studs will be the load bearing for the lintel, right? Oh, okay. So, like, the terms are all kind of loose, and it's what area you're in as to which is the correct one to use. So
that's interesting.
The book that I showed, The Carpentry by Vogt, it's one of the best resources for, like, all-encompassing carpentry.
Yeah.
And he does have it, you know, written out as to what the actual correct terms would be.
Yeah.
But if you get on a job site and you're the new guy, don't fight the foreman about what it's called. Just go with what he's saying.
Yeah.
As long as you understand what he means.
Yeah.
Hey, I saw this guy on TikTok.
He told me it was this.
Yeah.
Jeez. Well, as we wrap up here, Byron, you're going to go with our ending three questions here. What advice do you have for somebody who wants to get into carpentry?
I think it always falls back to the advice I received when I was working in a meatpacking plant, which is always watch what someone else is doing because you might be doing their job one day. And that doesn't mean stand around and, like, just watch what they're doing, but be aware of your surroundings and what's going on, because one of the worst positions you can put yourself in is being a carpenter or a carpenter's helper for 3, 4, or 5 years and still needing to go to someone and say, what's the next step? Mm. Like, you should be aware of your surroundings, both for your own safety, like, always have a way out, know what's going on around you, but then always be aware of where you should be going next and what you should be doing next. Because for a guy in my position, if I can give you a task and then see that you naturally go to the next task after you finish what I've given you, that's a win in my book. Mm-hmm. Like, if I say, hey, go cut these blocks, and you go and cut the blocks, and then you leave the stack of blocks at the bottom of the wall and say, hey, what's next? And I say, go install the blocks. And then you install the blocks. Yeah. And then you come back and say, hey, what's next? Sheet the wall, right? If we go through that once, that's great. If you're coming to me the second time and saying the same thing, third time, fourth time, then it's becoming too much. Like, always be aware of what's going on around you, so that you can better yourself and move forward, right?
Yeah. I had a conversation about that exact thing with some kids today, about not only just being aware, but also, like, anticipating what might be next. Like, if you're there helping someone and you know that they're going to need this tool on the next step, go grab that before they get to that step.
Yeah.
And then have it ready, and then just be really proactive about that. People really appreciate that.
Here's another good tip for the real up and comers. Like, if you're just the gopher and you're handing things to the guy who's working, when he asks for a tool, hand it to him in the orientation that he's going to use it.
Yes.
Right. So if you're handing him a drill, you hand it to him holding the head of the drill so he can grab the handle. If you're handing him a saw, you hold the auxiliary handle of the saw so he can grab the grip with the trigger so that it's in his hand and ready to use, and he doesn't need to touch it twice to make it functional.
Hmm.
I do that all the time because my dad hounded me. Hey, pass me the drill. And I'd pass him. I'd have the handle as a kid, right? Here you go.
Yep.
He's like, what's this going to do? Like, I can't do anything with it. And then over time, and even at school, you know, you just, you see things, or you're, you know, you're trying to do something and you ask a kid, hey, can you pass me that that nailer? And they pass it to you holding the, like the air hose and like the front of the, and it's like, I can't grab this thing, you know? And, but that, like, talk about efficiency. When you start doing that, and some of these people that have been in the trades for forever get a tool passed to them wrong. Oh, that gopher or a new person, they are going to get an earful, right? That is a great tip, because I think far too often, and again, that ties right back to your, be aware of your surroundings, you know? Yeah. Watch how other people are doing, and
definitely going to make a video about that.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey? Yeah, do it.
You'll see that one this week for sure.
That'd be awesome.
There, here's the 10 different ways to get X's, and then here's the proper way. Right? There's the throw, the over the hand toss.
No kidding.
Jeez.
That's so funny. Hand him the drill. It's got a bit in it, and you just like shove
through your hand.
The hell is this? What am I supposed to do with this? And I gotta, and it's like in your hand.
It's still turning. Hey, it's on.
Yeah. It's like voof, 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 voof. For some reason, your hand's made of steel.
The little things. What are some like some technical skill sets that would be good to develop for those that are wanting to get into the carpentry trade?
Technical skill sets.
Passing the tool properly.
Yeah. Tape measure is a big one. We get that one a lot.
Yeah. No, it does come down to understanding how your tools are used. And as much as, you know, you'll get to use tools on the job site, it is beneficial for you to like practice hammering nails at home and practice making straight cuts with the skill saw and like learning how to manipulate the tools, just because like they aren't natural motions. You have to learn how to do them. And that's probably the new guys. The biggest thing that I teach them is how to swing a hammer, because it's not taught. It's assumed. It's an assumed skill. Mm-hmm. And I have a carpentry book in the house. It was printed in 1910, I believe. Wow. And it has like two pages dedicated on technique of swinging a hammer with diagrams.
Wow.
And it's like, this isn't taught anymore. People just assume it's a hammer, you swing it. And so you often get these guys that are just like stiff wristed and basically punching nails in with the head of a hammer that's above their hand. Right. And it's like, Oh, give that thing some motion. So yeah, it's the understanding the mechanics of how your body uses the tools and not fighting the use of the tools. Cause like pinching lumber is another big one. Like just the read the owner's manual on the skill saw. It'll tell you how to avoid the pinch of lumber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yes, I have read the owner's manual on the skill saw. I'm a bit of a nerd like that. So.
Well, and being able to manipulate the tools, you know, different. I mean, obviously, straight cuts with a circular saw. You've also got a speed square potentially, but then there's also, you could be plunge cutting with a circular saw or skill saw, right? So, like, totally, you know, a lot of these tools have four or five different ways to use them. And I think just like anything, that repeatability and practice, because not lots of times, I think going onto sites, you're going to be able to just, you know, you might have to do, like you said, a lot at home. So that when you get to the job site, or your boss or foreman or journeyman's like, hey, you need to cut, you know, 300 studs at this length, you don't have to, you know, spend all this time laying out with the speed. I go to the speed square because I'm a cabinet maker and I just want to make sure it's square, because I don't trust myself. Because again, I don't know how to use a circular saw. But again, after practice, you probably build that tolerance and know how your body moves that to be able to better use the piece of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. Last one, top three starting out tools. What are they?
Top three starting out tools. The best thing is comfortable workwear.
Because no one said that
yet. Hey, that's a great one.
It took me a while to figure that out, but if you can be comfortable at work, you're going to enjoy it more. And you spend more time in your work clothes than you do anything else. Yeah. So, like... workwear, good workwear, it's pricey.
Yeah.
But the comfort level that you have at work pays for it. Like, so be comfortable, like get pants that have some stretch in them, you know, get, for where I am, get rain gear that actually keeps the water out.
And breathes probably.
And breathe. Yeah. So the smart fabrics are definitely a thing to look into. Yeah. And so you want three tools. So workwear is one. Get yourself a good hammer. It doesn't have to be like the expensive hammers. I'm trying to.
What's that one that you said I didn't need?
The stiletto.
Stiletto.
That's a nice hammer. I've got one. That's right over there. No, you don't need to buy like the, okay, stiletto, Martinez. Those are like the cat's meow, the Cadillac of framing hammers, right? You don't need that. That's something to work towards. Reward yourself when you hit a milestone, when you know it's going to be your career, then get the really nice stuff. But don't just go buy any hammer and think it's going to swing, right? Do pick the right hammer for the job. So yeah, a good hammer, because while we're not driving nails all day, you do still pull your hammer out all day long. Mm-hmm. And on a note on the stiletto, it drives nails beautifully. It does not move walls. Okay. That's just
tried, tested, and true.
View of it. Because it's a lightweight hammer, so you can swing it really fast. And so that'll drive a nail. But if you swing it, a lightweight hammer, really fast at a 600 pound wall, it's not going to move. So.
So what's a good hammer for moving walls then?
You want something that's head heavy.
Okay.
So a stiletto it's a 15 ounce hammer, but that includes the weight of the handle and it's all titanium. So the weight is kind of distributed evenly throughout it. Whereas, like the old school S-wing, mm-hmm. it's got this really narrow steel, shank with a rubber grip on the end, and then all the weights in the head of it, right? So that's gonna, like, the kinetic energy and potential energy is gonna move differently through it than if you have 15 ounces where half of it's in your grip.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, 70% of it with the S wing would be in the head.
Okay.
Right. So
wow.
I got one of those in my toolbox. I think my dad passed that down to me.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's okay. So I just want to say, from someone who knows nothing about any of this stuff, I'm so impressed by both of you. But I've seen like a lot of people in the carpentry woodworking trade about how, like, maybe in all of them, I don't know. Just, I'm really impressed by people who are very intentional about, like, I would have never thought about hammer science and hammer weight distribution and, well, I move a wall, you need this one with the head, like, it's a hammer, you know. I never thought about that before, so that's really
interesting. I never thought about it either until I started swinging one, right?
Fair enough. Yeah.
So then it was like, when I started, a friend of mine who had left the industry, he gave me his wood handled stiletto. So it's a wood handle with a titanium head. It's a really nice hammer. And so I got to start swinging like greener than green with a really nice hammer. And then I ended up breaking the handle on it, which then I needed to replace, but I needed something in the intern. So I grabbed a fiberglass master crap that we had kicking around in the garage, took that to work for a day while, you know, I had to go get a new handle or whatever. That was the worst day working ever. Like, the hammer makes a difference.
Oh, it's fascinating. Because I just think it's so crazy how deep you can dive into some of these very seemingly simple
on the surface
things. Yeah. On the surface.
Like theoretical breakdowns.
Yeah. Or like a hammer or an anvil or tools like that are, it's a chunk of metal.
A ratchet.
Yeah. Right?
Like, there's tons of stuff, oh, yeah. You know?
Or just like you said, there's that book, and does it, I don't know, maybe does it get lost on newer generations? Like that book that you talked about, where it has two pages on this, on the technique of how to swing a hammer.
Yeah.
Like, when was the last time you saw that? You know?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's, oh, it's really, because it flies in the face of the instant gratification that we are faced with in the world today, right? And it's like, well, no. Even things like a saw or how a file works. What way do you use a file? And, you know, like all these simple tools that could have a textbook dedicated to just that, you know? It just blows me away.
I'm definitely on a journey of collecting all those textbooks, because I've got another one from, it was printed in 1890, and it's all about stairs and like helical handrails and curved stairs. And this is all before, you know, lasers and computers, right? And it's the how-to of drafting these helical handrails and goosenecks and all the stuff that everyone on the internet says, oh, just use the app, or, you know, just hit the diagonal button on your calculators. Yeah. Well, that didn't exist one day. Yeah. And if you knew what the diagonal button did, you'd probably be a more well-rounded carpenter. So.
Yeah. Well, what's the third tool?
Third tool. That's going to be yourself. Like, invest in yourself. If the trade is something you want to do, sharpen your skill set. And that means not even just the use of your hands, but your brain as well. Like, make sure you know what you're doing and then work with intention. That's something that I'm continually working on is I always want to be learning. So, one of the funniest things ever said to me was right after I got achieved my Red Seal was, the guy said, we were acquaintances, but we didn't really talk very often. He said to me, so what do you do for work? And I said, well, I just got my Red Seal in carpentry. And he was like, oh, why would you do that? All you do is put a stud every 16 inches. And wow. I was like, well, yeah, that's kind of what the world thinks we do, but there's so much more. And I've done, you know, the woodworking in flooring manufacturing. I've done the cabinet making and countertop millwork and that stuff. And now I've had a large focus on framing and forming, and there's always something to learn about carpentry. So if you want to be in a skilled trade, just go learn about that skilled trade. Because you'll get better at your job the more you know about it.
And investing in yourself, do you flip that to the other side and like take care of yourself and like that, the mental health side and the wellness side too? Is that important for obviously a very laborious position working out in the rain and weather and, you know, lifting heavy stuff?
I'm just learning about that now. So
okay.
I'm on a self-care journey myself.
Yeah.
Different podcast topic for sure, but I went through some really dark stuff not too long ago, and getting focused on, you know, taking care of yourself, spending time in your interests, and like, as crazy as it sounds, I can learn about carpentry and be relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can go to my job and be stressed out and do my work. Mm-hmm. But reading historical carpentry books is quite relaxing.
It's your jam.
And really
That's
interesting.
Sweet. That's sweet.
So,
awesome.
You need that. You need those things to fill yourself back up.
Yeah.
Right? When you're drained throughout the day and you get home and you're like, I just want to learn how to swing a hammer, man.
he's gonna find that textbook.
Yeah. What's that called? Yeah. Yeah.
That one's in Audell's Carpentry or Contractor's Guide. I think it's in volume 1 or 2.
That's cool. You are a nerd. I love it. Volume 1 or 2. It's page 73. Yeah. Volume 2. That's so cool.
I'll send you a screenshot of this.
Yeah, please. Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of the workwear, I'm curious, do you have a go-to? I mean, we talk about the whole workwear, but like the work pants and stuff, everybody's got their kind of go-to. What's your go-to work pant?
I've been living in True Work.
Okay.
So yeah. They're Their T2 pants and their T3 pants are phenomenal. I've got multiple seasons on a few pairs of them, and they're comfortable, they're breathable, they're stretchy, they're water repellent. The T3s are insulated, and if they tear, like if working around rebar, everything gets shredded, right?
Oh yeah.
And so if I snag rebar, the pants will tear, but the tear won't continue. Like it won't. It'll just
Oh.
slice for what it's cut on, and then it doesn't grow,
Wow.
which is really nice. So, yeah.
Wow. Hard to keep up with that because there's obviously like the Carhartt. I've been through Thrive pants. I've gone through a whole bunch of some students. I got a student in my class who's gone to the Black Ladder.
Yep.
Gone there, and it's just interesting to see who, you know, and it obviously depends on what you're doing. Are you outside in the elements? Do you need the stretch? Are you know, there's just so much stuff where it's like, how do you know where to begin? I've pulled the trigger online and just, oh, I'm gonna try a new pair of work pants, and you get them and you're like, holy crap, these things don't fit. There's no stretch. When I do the fly up, it sucks into my guts. Like, you know, like you really have to, like you said, staying comfortable or being comfortable, and having good workwear. That can mean having a good day and being productive, or you know, pulling your pants up or whatever, just not being comfortable, your efficiency is going to go downhill quick.
I wore a Mascot for a long time too. Those were nice. Kind of the same deal, but they're a European based company and difficult to get in Canada. So
Yeah.
Did you find there's when we were talking about workwear, a few minutes ago? I had this question in my mind and then I forgot to ask it. But did you find it? Because when I first started like working in, I guess trades is, when I was in high school, you had to get the cat boots. Hey, you had to get a pair of cats, and they're 85 pounds each, and then you're out
Back
there.
before there was the composite toe,
Yeah, back before
quarter inch plate in those puppies.
it was carbon steel
Yeah.
toe. And then, Carhartt, you get like a work pant, is it the Dickies, whatever it is. And like, you almost felt like you needed to tough through the discomfort. Is it weird to shift? I don't know if you felt that way, but I did. Is it weird now to shift? Be like, holy, I'm pretty comfortable here. This doesn't feel like I'm at work. I feel like I'm in my sweatpants. So
Pajamas.
where are my work pants to bed? Hey.
I've got work pants for work and then work pants for home. I wear the same pants
That's cool.
all the time. It's yeah.
But was it like a weird shift though? Like when you first got into, because I remember wearing getting a comfortable pair of work pants, and then I just felt weird. Like I was like
Something's not
slacking.
right. It's in your
Like
head,
I'm like
right? No.
slacking, or you know what I
For
mean?
me,
Like
it was more like,
you're not supposed to
oh.
be comfortable at work, or
So
whatever.
the problem is I've never really had comfortable clothes because I'm 6'5" and 160 pounds soaking wet. So I'm like, clothes don't fit me. So when I find clothes that fit, it's a really good thing. And it just happened to be that those clothes were actually workwear clothes. So it was just like my whole life got better when I found
Just one pair
clothes
of pants, that's all you
that
need. Now you just have to buy one pair of pants, though, right? You know what to do online. You don't have to worry about trying on stuff. Get your jam. Yeah.
When they're on sale,
Yeah.
buy 40 pairs of them,
Exactly.
and you're good for the rest of your career. Oh man. Well, Byron, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today. We
Yeah.
really
Great.
appreciate your time sharing your wisdom and oh, tons of wisdom. And I'm looking forward to with all of these older books that you're getting, all these like construction relics or carpentry relics that you're reading. I'm sure there's going to be some like really cool content coming out.
Yeah, I'm looking into, it's expensive, but looking into taking another course to really expand my understanding of three-dimensional space. So it's a subject that's not taught in North America. It's called stereotomy, and it's got some French word. Because it's taught in France and Japan and Italy, I think. But it's something that I'm looking to get into to help me better understand three-dimensional space. And yeah, timber framers seem to like it. So it's not something I'm doing right now, but.
You should go down to the Maker Camp. Hey, the Catskills one where they do timber, they'll do timber framing.
Yeah.
What they do one every year.
Yeah. Have you heard about that one?
No.
Oh, it's in East Durham, New York.
Yeah.
Catskills Maker Camp. They have a big timber in. A bunch of our, some of the guests we've had are in charge of the timber framing stuff, and they, a whole bunch of companies. You get welders,
blacksmiths,
wood-lathe blacksmith, or you can build knives. It's kind of like a big, it's a big maker camp, which is pretty cool. That timber frame stuff has always kind of intrigued me. That, yeah. You know, if I ever came into some money or had an opportunity to maybe retire early to go do some timber framing, would be a really cool opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, as we wrap up, Byron, where can people find you? And is there anything you want to promote? Anything else you have going on right now?
I can be found almost anywhere online under the handle Byron Builds. So I've got a small YouTube, a large Instagram, a medium-sized TikTok. And if you're having trouble finding me on any of those, byronbuilds.com. I've got merch under the We The Trades banner and stickers, hoodies, you know, that kind of stuff. And any support that comes through there just helps me keep doing what I'm doing here. Like,
love it.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll link to all those definitely in the show notes of this episode. But thanks again for coming on. We hope you had a good time, and we really appreciate you sharing all your wisdom with us. Man, I could ask you, I have a ton more questions. We're at an hour 20, so.
That's fine. We can do a part two if you want.
Yeah, that'd be sweet. Right on. Well, thanks again, Byron. Thanks, Hoff.
Thanks, Rosie.
And we'll catch everyone in the next one.